the practice that we've been doing, the practice of Vajrasattva meditation, a practice on the image or the similitude of Vajrasattva, is something that in the Buddhist tradition is done within the context of a certain set of teachings, which I haven't really talked about explicitly for a while. So I thought I wanted to go back to that for just a minute, just by way of kind of review and overview, and then talk a little bit in detail about some elements of the practice. And that's what I want to do for a while, is do a little bit of, when I say for a while, I mean for a number of meetings, is do kind of a little bit of overview or context as a refresher, and then talk about the specifics of practice, and specific little elements of practice, so that you can kind of build your understanding of how the pieces fit together and why they're important, because nothing is really necessarily self-evident. And a lot of things Kay and I have only figured out over the years of practice. Hopefully we figured them out. Who knows? My interpretations may be aberrant or even heretical for all I know. No, there's no such thing as heresy in Buddhism, so that's not possible. But aberrant, that is possible. Or unique, my own. So caveat emptor, not, yeah. So the whole of the Buddhist teaching was once boiled down by Tsongkhapa, who was really one of the great teachers in Tibetan Buddhist history. It was boiled down to a 14-stanza poem, which was called The Three Principal Aspects of the Path. So he really boiled everything down to three aspects or three elements of the path. And actually that's the Buddhist term for what practice is the path, which is to say what one does to get from one place to another, from where one is to where one wants to go, wherever that is. And the idea of being able to boil this down into sort of a systematic formulation goes back about 1,200 years in Buddhist history. But as I say, it eventually got boiled down to these three principal aspects. And the way those are usually summarized or described is that the three aspects are renunciation, wisdom, and altruism. When I teach in the university context, as soon as I start talking about renunciation, I lose everybody. It's like, what is this renunciation? What are we supposed to be renouncing? What is that? So the idea is actually very simple, which is that in our ordinary life, in the world, we can expect to not have lasting satisfaction, and we should give up the idea that there'll be lasting satisfaction. This is not a teaching of otherworldliness or world renunciation. It's just an honest recognition that the nature of life is that whatever we want, we're going to lose sometimes. Sometimes we won't, but sometimes we will. Whatever we don't want, sometimes we won't get, but other times we will get. And no matter what's going on, it's going to change. And if you think any of the above is not true, then you're going to be pretty unhappy. So you might as well accept the fact that these things will happen and just sort of get on with things and not worry about it too much, but also not expect that you're going to find complete satisfaction in a worldly life, that you have to add another dimension to it. And that's a way of understanding the meaning of that idea, which is typically called renunciation, but it has sort of a broader meaning. And I've pretty much found that to be true in my life, which is that if I just go about leading an ordinary life, have a nice home, have a nice job, it's not really enough. Have good family, friends, all this kind of stuff, that there's just something missing, though I don't always know what it is. And so it's that sense of something's not complete. That's really the idea. Altruism is the idea that we're all deeply connected to each other, And that if we live a life which ignores that, then a lot of the stuff that doesn't work out for us will not work out for us even more intensively. Whereas if we live a life where we recognize our connection with others, and our deep connection with others, and that we're completely dependent in, that our happiness in particular depends upon others, then there's more possibility of happiness in life. One has to recognize that living a life for one's own ends alone is ultimately not terribly satisfying. And finally, wisdom, or the view, is the view that everything is impermanent, and lacks a lot of what the characteristics that we believe belong to it. So if you look back at some of the recordings that I've posted online, you'll see all those things explained in greater detail. But that is the context for all meditation practice, and it's an important context. It's obvious the way we're practicing with Vajrasattva that there's an altruistic intention to all this, because I'm talking very explicitly about a relationship with others. But it's easy to forget, for example, the teachings of emptiness or devoidness or wisdom, and to imagine the image of Vajrasattva, which for us is a similitude, something we're creating, as if it's solid and tangible, because our minds will do that. You know, you'll imagine Vajrasattva as luminous even, but solid luminous, like a sun or a star or a light bulb or a candle flame or something like that, or a crystal that's passing light through it. Our minds just go to seeing even the things that are the creation or the products of our mind as being solid. And it's not. It shouldn't be. If you imagine Vajrasattva as a solid, tangible something, like a person, rather than a transparent, luminous, vaporous, non-tangible entity, then there are problems in practice. And I can't really articulate what all the problems are, mostly because this is one of the faults of my own practice on a pretty consistent basis, so I'm very familiar with it as a fault. I'm not entirely all that familiar with it as a non-fault, but our lamas have been very specific about this, so I share that with you as something that's important to remember. I do have some sense of why it's important, but that's not something I really terribly want to get into tonight, because I really want to work with a sort of a different theme. And that's to go back, just to step back for a minute, and then to step forward. To step back, I've often talked about the way in which thoughts and energy kind of relate to each other, and that where a thought exists, there is a kind of energy called wind energy, or qi, if you like the Chinese, or spirit, if you like that sort of thing. That where thoughts exist, energy exists, and where mental energy exists, there are always thoughts, and that they kind of carry each other around. And we can see in our own experience that if we're really agitated, we have certain kinds of thoughts, and if we have calmer minds, we have different kinds of thoughts. And that certain thoughts will calm our minds, and certain thoughts will agitate our minds. If we stop and think about it, we notice that relationship. But the relationship runs really deep. I mean, to use a kind of a philosophical term, it's ontological. It's in the nature of how thoughts exist, and it's in the nature of how energy exists, that they're kind of two sides to each other, if not the same thing. That's a subject of some debate. One of the things that I kind of like about the Tibetan way of teaching is that they're not afraid of ambiguity. So I once had a conversation with one of our lamas, Tara Tulku, and I said, so what is it? I mean, are they two sides of the same thing? Are they the same thing? Are they two different things? And he said, some people think they're one thing, two sides of the same thing. Some people think that, you know, just the two of them arise and cease together, and that's all that you know experientially. And some of them think that they're two different things. So which is it? He said, well, I told you. Some people think this, and some people think this, and some people think that. I said, what do you think? He said, that's what I think. You know, at the time, it seemed like a somewhat unsatisfactory answer. But over, you know, the 20 or so years reflecting on that, I realized it's actually a very profound answer, and it's an extremely satisfying answer. Because what he was saying is, you know, that question, I think what he was saying is, I should never say I know what he was saying. I think what he was saying was, you know, that question was formulated by a mind that wanted a definitive, it's this, this, or this. And the way the mind formulated that question leads to a number of possibilities. And so which is it? Well, when you know how your mind formulates questions, then you'll know what the answer is. I think that that's what he was getting at. He didn't really say it that way. He kind of left me with an interesting puzzle to work on for a number of years. But that's really very wonderful. It's very, you know, it's not doctrinaire, but it's also very challenging. So, and that leads me to another example of, well, not another example, but another observation was I once had a student in one of my university classes who asked me, you know, wasn't there a simple kind of book that would summarize everything about Buddhism, like, you know, Buddhism for Dummies? And I said, I'm sorry, Buddhism isn't for dummies. It challenges your mind because the fundamental flaw in human existence from the Buddhist point of view is our misunderstanding of things. That's where all the problems and unhappiness comes from. So there can't be a Buddhism for Dummies because it may be true that we're all dummies, but it is not a way of thinking about things or practicing that works really well for people who aren't willing to take the effort to really use their minds. And, of course, one should never say anything like that, because then the student got back to me in the week and said, here's the citation for where you can go on Amazon and get Buddhism for Dummies. Okay, you know. But anyway, all of that aside. Back to the task at hand. So, the nature of mind, you know, so is it, how is it related to the inner energies or winds? Well, so there are a number of possibilities. But whichever of the possibilities that you happen to like, there is some kind of relationship between them, and they affect each other in important ways. Now, the other thing that Tara Tulku taught us was that in the meditation practices of that we're doing, which are sometimes called Vajrayana, but they exist within this Buddhist context of the three principal aspects of the path, and he emphasized that very strongly. That in these meditation practices, a lot of times you find examples of something which you call making offerings, for, you know, kind of general language. For example, when we practice with Vajrasattva, there's a certain point where you imagine light going out from Vajrasattva, going out to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and making offerings, and then blessings come back and flow into Vajrasattva. There's a point where you imagine yourself making offerings. And usually, that's described in one of two ways. One way is light coming out of your heart, usually, that's sort of the vehicle for making offerings, or light coming out of Vajrasattva's heart, sort of going in, you know, all directions, like a globe out of his heart. And that light is the energy that carries thoughts. So it's the, you know, it's symbolic of that. So when you have the thought of light coming out of your heart or Vajrasattva's heart, when you have that thought, there's actually energy that's associated with it. And the energy takes the form of the thought. So if you imagine Vajrasattva in the space above you with light coming out, then actually what you're imagining is a point of conscious energy, which is the Vajrasattva, this purification energy, with light coming out of it like a star. And if you imagine it, it's so, because the thought and the energy move together. So if you have a thought of energy moving, energy moves. It's more obvious within your own body if you do that, but it's the same process. The other way that this is sometimes described is to imagine offering goddesses coming out of your heart and going to Vajrasattva or going out to the world or something like that. And it's the same thing. I mean, it's imagining energy going out from yourself. But you want to imagine positive energy going out from yourself. You don't want to imagine sort of, well, Super Bowl Sunday. You don't really want to imagine, you know, go out there and bang, smash, that kind of energy. I mean, you want to imagine something more positive. I mean, there's no particular altruistic virtue to imagining, I guess, you know, the Giants kicking the butt of the Patriots or the other way around. I mean, that's really not what we're trying to promote in our Buddhist practice. I mean, I'm sure
that society is doing that today.
I know. It may be very un-American and all that kind of stuff to be saying such things. And I'm sure that if my grand football coach heard me, he'd be appalled. But I think we'd be friends anyway. Let's see. I just sidetracked myself. This is a dangerous thing to do at this point in life. Excuse me. I'm getting a little hot here. The main point is, to get back to this, the main point is that what we're doing in this practice is we're imagining through these thought forms, we're creating and we're not just imagining. We use our imaginations, but imagining and imagination has kind of a bad rap in our society. That's sort of the problem. Okay? We're using our minds to create a similitude, to create a pattern of energy, which creates a certain set of thoughts, which in a sense creates a certain frame of mind. And depending upon the kind of energy that you generate and thoughts that you generate, then that's the frame of mind that you're generating. That's the mind that you're generating. And it's when I say that, it's easy to think, well, mind, that's just this mind. But mind isn't just this mind. I mean, there are many kinds of mind. There's levels of mind. There are wise minds. There are foolish minds. There are energetic minds. You know, I mean, and there's ways of knowing that are associated with different kinds of minds or states of mind. I mean, the Buddhists literally say different minds. They don't have a way of saying states of mind. In English, we think that there's one mind that has various states. But they don't talk that way because they would say you can't have one thing that has different conditions because then it's two different things or three different things or four different things. So they just say there are many minds. And that's something else that drives Americans crazy. It's like, I've only got one mind, don't I? No. You know, in any moment, you have a different mind. You know, I mean, like the mind of anger is not like the mind of love. We tend to think it's my mind that has different conditions, but they would say, no, those are different minds. But that's because they would say that you're not your mind and we're not so sure what we are. So, you know, that's part of the issue. Except for those of us that think we're our bodies. But I don't know that there are probably too many people in this room who would be thinking that. I don't know. Perhaps there are. It's easier to think, to fall into thinking that I am my mind, because we tend, again, as Americans, we're programmed to think that we're living inside of our bodies, so we can't be our bodies. So what's living inside of our bodies would be our minds. But that's not a very Buddhist way of thinking about things either. But that's a subject for another conversation, I guess. I'm getting sidetracked again. So the point is that if you then look at Vajrasattva practice in the context in which we've been doing it, which is the basic practice, which is you imagine the appearance of Vajrasattva, and then you imagine Vajrasattva making energy offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas then pour blessings on Vajrasattva, what you would imagine is a circle of energy. You would imagine energy going out and energy coming back. And when you think of, when you do the practice, when you recite the sadhana of the practice, again, it's easy to think like somebody turns on a light and light streams out and then light comes back and that's over. Now we go on to the next stage. Then Vajrasattva moves to the top of your head and light goes out and then light comes back. And then we go to the next stage. But these things are all going on at the same time. And what's happening with the radiance of light out of Vajrasattva and the blessings coming back to Vajrasattva is a circle of energy, or actually more like an endless loop. And that's, you know, that's what the Vajra represents. So I'll pass this around for people to look at. Like the figure eight infinity in our culture, what you have is this endless cycle of constantly reinforcing energy moving between Vajrasattva and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, constantly concentrating and moving back and forth and cycling. You know, the American Indians, you know, were sensible enough to say things like, nothing goes in a straight line. It's only modern people who think that things go in straight lines. And what's a straight line? A straight line is something that goes from one place to another and then that's the end of it. That doesn't make any sense. Nothing in the natural world is like that. The natural world is all a matter of cycles and flow and recurring patterns and so on and so forth. So this energy is moving in a circuit, if you will, and that's what's represented by the Vajra. It's constantly, effulgently emanating out of Vajrasattva and returning to Vajrasattva. It doesn't go out and come back. Even though the text makes it sound that way, it's constantly, effulgently emanating, and it's constantly returning. And why does that matter? Because that's a closed circle, and that's strong, and that's real. Similarly, there's a point where Vajrasattva sits on your crown, and the energy flows into you. Well, what is it that makes the cycle? Well, you've made offerings to Vajrasattva, and Vajrasattva is blessing you, and that's the circle. You're constantly making offerings to Vajrasattva outside of yourself, and Vajrasattva is constantly pouring blessings into you. It's a cycle. The Tibetans have enough sense to understand that when you meet the Lama, you don't go empty-handed. You give the Lama something, a scarf. It's a token, but it's a gift. It's a flow of energy. The Lama is giving you his teachings and blessings, and you're making a small token of an offering. And then there's probably your devotion, if you have it, and so on and so forth. And yeah, thank you. And the Lama usually gives a scarf back, and so the cycle closes in that particular way. And, you know, scarves travel. They travel. They go from person to person to person. They're constantly moving. They don't sit still. Well, not usually. I have a few scarves that I have on my personal shrine because they're special. Occasionally they move back and forth, but mostly they... But other scarves, you know, move in cycles. And similarly, though, when Vajrasattva enters you, you know, and the light goes out from you, it's going out to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it's going out to all the beings in the world, and they in turn are returning it to you, right? Because you know, what is it that all the beings in the world are concerned about? You know, they're concerned about the essence of, I mean, if they have a spiritual life and spiritual practice, they're concerned about reconnection with the essence of themselves. So in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha is the essence of yourself. So whether it's, you know, Buddhists making offerings to the Buddha or you know, thinking good thoughts about the Buddha or Muslims, I better not say this. Well, anyway, all religions, you know, have people being devoted to the essence of what it means to be a human being. And so that energy is constantly moving around. And that means that energy is moving through you. Just as you're giving that energy and that consideration to others, they're giving that to you, essentially, whether they know it or not. And so the practice of altruism, you know, which can appear like kind of an odd idea. I mean, for years, you know, I refused to take the Bodhisattva vows. because I thought, how can I say such a thing? I vow to save all sentient beings. I mean, I got a big ego, and I've been accused by lots of people of being arrogant, including my own lamas. And so I thought, how can I possibly say anything like this? But then at a certain point, I realized that actually, how could I say anything else? Because if I was really living if I was really living the spiritual practice that I believed I was living, which is closing cycles of energy, then in fact I am, sharing this energy and benefiting all beings, and they're doing the same to me. That the altruistic life, the altruistic attitude, is the only true and real way to live. That anything else is this kind of constrained, I'm holding on to my own, and we know where that goes. The attitude of I'm holding on to my own goes to I'm on my own. Well, of course, you're ultimately never on your own, but at least in the mundane sense, where it leads to is people who are cut off from each other. I think of the people who live in a world where they believe it's perfectly okay to, steal the pensions of little old ladies. Use sort of the classic, and that's fine, and that'll help them to buy their Cadillac or whatever, and that's just the world, that's just reality. The strong survive and the weak perish. That's the rationalization. I'm thinking, well, if you want to live that way, you live that way, but, you're creating a world of what I would imagine to be complete isolation, because you've created a world in which you're at battle with everybody else. And ultimately, anyway, if you create a world in which you're at battle with everybody else, in some way you've got to lose. If it's 1 versus 7 billion, what are the odds that you're not going to lose? That's just, I don't care if you're Donald Trump or who you are, in the end, it can't possibly work. The only way it can possibly work is if you and the 7 billion are compatriots and everybody's on the same side. And why wouldn't you want to live that way anyway? In a sense it's hard, and in a sense it's easy. So if it was really easy, we wouldn't have to do this practice. It would just like that be the way it is. But the way we're programmed by our culture and our language, and it's not just us, it's not like modern Americans only, the way we're programmed, we have this other view of things. And I say it's not just modern Americans only. I talk about these practices in the context of the problems of being an American, because they're all Americans. I wouldn't talk about these practices in the context of being Chinese, in the room is Chinese that I'm aware of. But, at least not this time around, but it's important to remember that Buddhism has existed all over, at least all over the Asian world, for a long time. It's 2,500 years old, and 2,500 years ago, when even in the great civilizations, nobody could read or write, because there wasn't any reading or writing in India, for example, 2,500 years ago, people still, in a certain sense, had the same problem. It was perhaps a different version of the same problem, but they had the same problem, So it's obviously not easy, because here it is, after 2,500 years, we're still talking about the same thing. But on the other hand, at the same time, we have at least from the Buddhist point of view, we have 2,500 years of accumulated wisdom on how to deal with a problem. So that's the good thing, which is really a good thing, because the problem has only gotten more complicated over 2,500 years, because our minds have changed and everything's gotten more complexified, and now we have the internet to really confuse us, and so on and so forth. I'm not knocking the internet. This is how I make a living. This is how Kay makes a living now, too. It's in its own way, it's a wonderful thing, but in another way, what a distraction. I see the students at the university walk out of the classroom, the first thing they do is flip open their smartphones to see who needs to be in touch with them. They're walking around texting. They go up and down the stairs texting. And I just can't imagine how that's possible. Maybe because I'm old and clumsy and I haven't seen anybody falling down the stairs, but it just really completely blows my mind, So, All right, again, sidetrack. The main thing is about this element of the practice, which is the making of offerings. Now, I've spoken about the making of offerings in a sort of a symbolic way or a mentally created way, but there's also the making of offerings in a tangible way, because, you know, what's the difference between the thing you think and the physical thing that you give? Now, for materialists, the only thing that matters is the thing that you give. But we're not all totally, strictly materialists, I don't believe. So, but it's easy, in my experience, it's easy to fall to the side of thinking, oh, okay, well, you know, mentally created offerings are what's important, the other stuff doesn't matter. Well, no, it all matters, you know. I mean, we're all very grateful to each other when we bring food to this gathering. You know, we nourish each other. When someone drops me a note and says something's been helpful, that means a lot to me. I'm very grateful for that, you know. These are tangible things. Kate puts flowers out because that's her gift, and that's very important. So the physical thing that we do is also important. And then you can cross the line. And Tibetans are very good at making tangible offerings to the bodhisattvas that they're imagining. So I think for Americans, that becomes a little bit more complicated. We can imagine mental offerings to mentally created beings, and physical offerings to physical beings. It becomes a little bit more challenging to make physical offerings to that which we imagine to be mentally created. But why? I mean, the only difference between something that's physical and something that's mental, I mean, if you think about it, even from the point of view of modern physics, is that the thing that's physical is just slower moving energy than the thing that's mental. Otherwise, it's all the same, you know. So we make these distinctions which are problematic. So that's where the wisdom side of the three principal aspects of the path come in, of recognizing the little false boxes we stick ourselves in so we can get out of those boxes. So again, and you know, these don't have to be fancy things. Water offerings are very popular among the Tibetans. Kay likes to make water offerings. I make water offerings.
Can I say something about
that? Of course.
Yeah, in Tibetan Buddhism, they are, you know, because of the early monks and nuns were wanderers, you know, and, you know, they baked for food and sustenance, basically. So they didn't have a lot, but they had a bowl, right? So what they would use to make offerings basically was a bowl, their bowl, and they put water in it. You know, and that's like the most simple offering that you can make is just to take, you know, imagine within our tradition we often we say Om Ahum a lot. Mm-hmm. Just imagine, you know, the water transforming into something that's beatific or nectar, you know, by saying Om Ahum, Om Ahum, Om Ahum into the water and then, you know, offering it up. A very simple practice. Very easy to do, you know, like once a day, you know, to do something like that when you start your day. And it's amazing. You'll find that once you do it over a period of time, that it has amazing impact on you. Another one that Thich Nhat Hanh always encouraged people to do was to take, you know, those little sticks of incense. And if you can't have it inside, like we have the Buddha outside here, because it bothers me too, but take a piece of incense and light it and, you know, mindfully, you know, walk out to your garden and put a piece of incense somewhere. If you don't have a Buddha or something out there, that's okay. Just make it to the all the beings, you know.
And the Buddha's everywhere anyway.
Beings. Yeah, the Buddha's bodhisattvas, and just, you know, pop it into the ground there. A more complicated one is, you know, you see the seven or eight bowls that are on our altar there. And plant, basically the Tibetans, it's like Argyam, Pajyam, Gande, Pushpe, Dupe, Aloke, Navaja, Shabda, Pratichyam, Swaha. And what that is Argyam is face washing. Yeah, let's do this together with our hands here. Let's just try this. Okay. Argyam. Ahum. Okay. Now, then that's face washing water. Okay. Pajyam Ahum is you take your right hand and kind of turn it. Like this is your foot washing water. Okay, so Gande Ahum is offering incense or perfume. to the heart.
You imagine rubbing it.
Yeah, like in the old days when they came in, they took sandalwood paste and threw it over the heart of the guest. So that's Gandhi, Ahum. Okay, and then Pushpe Ahum is flowers, and you just imagine your hands opening. That's Pushpe Ahum. And then the Dupe Ahum is incense, and that's and like the smoke, and that just goes the other way. So it's kind of closing again. Then Aloke Ahum, the flame. Aloke Ahum.
So you imagine like a bowl with a flame in it.
Yeah, with a flame in it. Aloke Ahum. And then Navaja Ahum is the food offering. Ahum.
It's a bowl.
The bowl with the food in it. And then Shabda Ahum. It's just these two fingers, and just so it's like
playing the drum,
or playing the drum and bell.
Oh,
yeah, music.
So these are the traditional eight Indian offerings to a
right.
guest.
And you can put, you know, like the seven or is it eight? Yeah, eight offering bowls on a little altar, and pour water into them. And then you can, there's also the hand movements that can go with it, and the mantra, Argyam, Pajam, Gandhi, Pushpe, Dupe, Aloke, Navaja, Shakta, Paticham, Swaha, do the hand movements with it, and visualize that the water has turned into nectar, and then into these items, like the bowl is full of scented water to wash your face, another bowl is full of scented water to wash the feet, another bowl is full of perfume, some sandalwood paste to put on the heart, another bowl is full of flowers to offer. Another bowl is full of incense. And another bowl is full of food. And another bowl is full of music. And it's just water. Right? Just water. And just take it. And then usually what I do is I take the old water. You put it in a quart into a pitcher from the seven bowls. And you take it outside. And at Zen Center, we used to do this little thing called the water with it which we fill these bowls tastes like ambrosia. We offer it to the various spirits to satisfy them. Om Maha Kusalaya Swaha. I just take it out and sprinkle it over the garden in the morning. And so it's kind of like, and there, if you read some of the books by the different lamas that can actually see some of these beings that we can't see, that they say they actually see them when this water comes out, mm-hmm. or when you take an offering from like a puja or a torma, mm-hmm. out, that they actually see the beings all come and take the offering. So it's, you know, anyway, it's a very enriching practice, and it doesn't take a lot of time. It doesn't take, you have to buy anything, except maybe a bowl, but most of you have a bowl. And I encourage you to think about.
And just as an example of, you know, turning things inside out, thinking outside of the box, we talk about water is the simplest thing. Everybody has access to it. It doesn't cost anything, and so on and so forth. But if there's anything more precious than water, I'm not sure what it is. Maybe air. I mean, try to live without water for a while, and you'll find out how precious it is. Or be in a place where there's not clean drinking water, and you find out how precious it is. It's one of the most precious things that we simply take for granted, and so that's practice in itself. So I think that's that for the time being, and then we'll come back and we'll do a little meditation after we have a snack. I don't know about those little sausages in there.